Okay, so this is Bio 160, and you got a quiz today at the end of class on muscles, which is what? Chapter 8. So we're going to go over the study guide. I'm going to finish up I'm so sorry. Let me take this. This is Dr. Sanchez. Hello, say hi to the class. I left my phone on. Right. So I was going to call you to tell you I found some CDs in lab, but they're the wrong edition. They're the fourth edition. Yeah, they're the old ones. So if you can, find those, the fifth edition, that would be great. Okay, thanks. Bye. Okay, please turn your cell phones off. All right, so we were talking about muscles, and I got a note to start here. So we are going to start right here. I don't know how I'm going to keep it on the projector. Maybe that will work just like that. All right, so what is muscle specialized to do?
To contract,
right? And let's see, we talked about the structural and functional unit of contraction. What is that?
Sarcomere.
That's the sarcomere. And what kind of proteins do you have in the sarcomere? And which one shortens?
When
it can, you have actin and myosin, and which one of those two shorten? Or do they both shorten?
Neither
of them shorten. How would you explain how a sarcomere gets shorter? That's right. The actin and myosin slide over the top of each other. And they pull on each other, actually, because of the cross bridges from myosin. Right. So what energy molecule is necessary to have the actin and myosin slide over them? Yeah, ATP is the energy molecule. And I don't know if I talked about this because I can't remember, but there is a signaling molecule that allows myosin to grab the actin and pull on it.
Calcium.
And that is that calcium signal. Yeah, did we talk about where calcium comes from inside the cell?
Yeah.
The sarcoplasmic reticulum, right? So you got to have calcium inside the muscle fiber, and you have to have ATP in order for the actin and myosin to slide over each other. All right, so that's a nice molecular discussion of muscle and muscle contraction. Actually, I wanted to find out. Somebody sent me an email, and I'm not sure exactly who you are. Or I think you're in this class, but I'm recording. And I sent an email back to somebody whose name is similar, but not exactly. They were kind enough to write back and say they weren't actually the person, but let me put that recorder over here. It was Teresa. Is Teresa here? Oh, Teresa. See me after class, okay? Because I didn't know where to send the email to you. Okay. See me after class. Great. Okay. All right. So we're going to start with muscle anatomy. So this is gross anatomy. And when we say gross anatomy, what do we mean? We don't mean revolting, disgusting. We mean just large. Gross means large. The kind of anatomy that you can see with your naked eye, right? And don't forget a myofibril and a sarcomere and all that kind of stuff, the actin and myosin, myofilaments. That's not gross anatomy because you can't see those things with your naked eye. You need microscopes or even fancy electron microscopes to see these kinds of structures. Okay, so let's talk about stuff that's big, that's easy to see. All right, so most muscles extend from one bone to another, and it's going to cross a joint. And so when that muscle gets stimulated, what does the muscle do? Does it push, or does it pull, or can it do both? A muscle can only pull, can never push. So when a muscle contracts, it's going to pull these two bones together, and it's going to cause that joint to move, that articulation to move one way or the other. All right, some muscles, a few muscles are attached to skin, like facial muscles. You can raise your eyebrows. There's a muscle in your forehead that when it contracts, it pulls your eyebrows up. Right, and there's even a little muscle in your skin that we talked about that gives you goosebumps. What's the name of that muscle? Erector pili muscle, right? But most muscles attach to bones. We can find some examples that attach to soft tissue, but most attach to bones. And most muscles have, generally speaking, two ends, two different ends, and we give them two different names. We call one end the origin and the other end the insertion of a muscle. And the way that we define it is that the origin is the more stationary end of a muscle. or attachment point to the body. That's the origin. So when a muscle contracts, it's not going to move both bones. One bone is going to stay stationary, and the other end of the muscle is going to pull on a bone that moves. So the origin is the more stationary end of the muscle. The insertion is the other end of the muscle that is actually producing a motion in your body. And we're going to look at a couple examples of that. And what helps attach a muscle to a bone? A tendon, yeah. So a bone-to-muscle connection is a tendon. And a bone-to-bone connection, of course, is a ligament. We're already familiar with that. Okay. So, for instance, if we look at a nice muscle right here, for instance, the biceps brachii, sometimes we name muscles by what they actually look like, by their shape. And the biceps has two origins, hence the name bi, right? Okay. And brachii is used because this is in the brachium, and the brachium is just what, the anterior part of your arm. So a lot of times we name muscles by what their shape is or where their location is in the body, so you don't have to memorize everything. Right? Okay, so here's the biceps brachii. When it contracts, I tell you what, let's talk about the places where it is attached. It's attached to the scapula, which is a bone in your back. Right, and the other end is attached to the radius, which is the lateral bone in your forearm. And so when the biceps brachii contracts, something is going to move. Either the scapula is going to move or the radius is going to move. And I'll just tell you, when the biceps contracts, that flexes the forearm. I think we learned, did we learn motions already in here? I think when we looked at joints, we learned motions like flexion, extension, right, rotation, abduction, adduction. So when the biceps brachii contracts, this muscle shortens, and the radius is pulled up toward the scapula, and we call that flexion. So the scapula does not move, and since the scapula doesn't move, we call that the origin of the biceps brachii. And what bone does move? It is the radius. So that's the insertion, that little tubercle on the radius right there is the insertion of the biceps brachii. All right, so you know the biceps brachii is right there. If you contract that muscle, you can just see what part of your body actually moves. It's not your scapula, it's your forearm that moves. So hence the insertion down over here on the radius. And this is what we call the coracoid process that doesn't move. Okay, so that's how we consider origins and insertions. Well, there's other ways that we can talk about muscles. For instance, some muscles are what we call synergists. Synergist muscles are two muscles, or maybe three muscles, maybe four muscles, that produce the same kind of motion. They work together to perform the same motion. And in your arm, since we're looking at the arm, there are two muscles. One is the biceps brachii. We've looked at that one already. And another one, the brachialis, which is deep to the biceps brachii. What does that mean? What does it mean when it's deep? It's below or underneath. So for instance, right here is the biceps brachii, right in this region. And then right underneath it, right in this region here, is the brachialis muscle. And since they're in the same body compartment, the anterior arm, they produce the same kind of motion, which is what? Flexion of the forearm. And as a matter of fact, the brachialis is actually the stronger of the two muscles. All right? But these two muscles work together to perform flexion. So the biceps brachii and the brachialis are what we call synergists. They perform the same kind of motion. All right. Along that same kind of line, if you have a number of muscles that are producing the same kind of motion, usually one muscle of that whole group is doing most of the work. And that muscle that's doing most of the work is what we call the prime mover. So in this previous example, the brachialis is what we call the prime mover because it's the strongest muscle that causes forearm flexion. And then lastly, the way that we talk about some muscles is through a process of antagonism. And we've talked about antagonism before, right? It's actually a very good thing to have in your body because what does it give to your body? It gives balance and precise control over your body. So what do we mean by antagonistic muscles? Muscles which that work in opposition to each other. And a good example of this would be the biceps brachii, since we're talking about that already. That's for forearm flexion. Well, there's got to be a muscle that produces the opposite motion. What's the opposite of flexion? It is extension. And the muscle that does that is called the triceps brachii. The biceps brachii is in the anterior arm, but the triceps brachii is in the posterior arm, right over here. They're on opposite sides of your arm, so they produce opposite motions. Now, why is that such a good thing? Well, let's just say that you had a biceps brachii, but no triceps brachii. Let's just say, for instance, maybe you didn't have one. So whenever the biceps brachii contracted, what would happen? Even if it was very weakly, what would happen? You would just punch yourself in the face because you couldn't stop your arm. Okay? So the reason why you have precise control of your hand is because as you're moving your hand up toward your face, you start to contract the triceps brachii a little bit, and it can break the action of the, I mean, slow down the action of the biceps brachii, so you can put your finger exactly in space where you need it to be. All right, so the triceps brachii causes extension, the biceps brachii causes flexion. Those are antagonistic motions, so these are antagonistic muscles, but it gives you the ability to put your finger exactly in space where you want it to go with the force that you want it to generate. And as a matter of fact, that might even be the most important idea in this class, is how does your body maintain balance, okay, and control? And very important systems are always built on antagonistic principles or antagonistic mechanisms. So could you tell me two mechanisms in your car that are antagonistic to each other? But you would never dream of driving your car without these two antagonistic mechanisms. Yeah, like the gas and the brake pedal, right? Because if you only had a gas pedal, you could drive home. But once you got home, you would have to do what? Well, just wave goodbye because you couldn't stop. Okay? Okay, so antagonism is very important. All right, well, let's look at a couple muscles. We're not going to learn a whole lot of muscles, but a couple to get a flavor for what's going on. Okay, let's talk, and so we're going to break it down into muscles in the head. We're going to talk about some muscles in the neck, then some trunk muscles, and then a muscle in an appendage, which is either an upper arm, or I mean an arm or a leg. All right, so for head muscles, a lot of muscles are named by their origin and insertion. Okay, so here is a name of a muscle that kind of looks intimidating, but it's not really hard to appreciate. So I'll say occipito frontalis. And when you hear that word occipito, you're familiar with this one already, because what bone kind of rhymes with occipito? Like the occipital bone, right? Where is that occipital bone at? It's way in the posterior part of your head, right? Kind of at the floor of your brain right there. Well, that's one part of this muscle. And when a muscle is named after the bones that it attaches to, the first bone is always going to be the origin, which is the least movable end of that muscle. All right, and then we see another bone right here, frontalis. Where's that bone at? It's the frontal bone. Right. All right, so now the occipital frontalis really doesn't attach to that bone, because the joints between the occipital bone and frontal bone really don't move. Your head doesn't move when you contract that. But the occipital frontalis does attach to skin above the eyebrows, which helps you raise your eyebrows when the occipital frontalis muscle contracts, right? And remember, the end of the muscle that is producing motion is called what? The insertion or the origin? It's the insertion. It's the insertion. So the insertion is the frontalis, right? And the occipito is the origin, because that's the least movable end of the muscle. So let's take a look at the occipito frontalis. Here we see a beautiful picture of somebody's head. And we're going to look right at the top of the head. Here's the occipital bone. Here's the frontal bone. This muscle right here is what we call the frontalis part of the occipito frontalis. And if we go all the way back, here is the occipitalis. But notice that the occipitalis and frontalis are connected together by this broad, flat, tendinous sheath right here. That's what we call an aponeurosis. An aponeurosis is just a very broad, flat, tendinous sheath. So there's no muscle on the top of your head. There's just a tendon that connects the frontalis and the occipitalis. These contract together so that when they contract, when the occipitalis contracts, that pulls on the aponeurosia, that pulls on the frontalis, and that pulls on what? The eyebrows. So that helps raise your eyebrows. So the occipital frontalis is a very important muscle for facial expression. And facial expression is very important in communication, maybe even more so than exactly what you say, right? It's how you say something that gives meaning to it, and also the facial expression that you use. Like right now, some of you are looking at me kind of funny that you're going to have to know some of this stuff. But it's not bad. It's not hard to remember, as long as you can remember names of these bones. Okay, so here is the insertion, because it moves when you contract. All right, what's another muscle? Well, let's move down to the neck. All right, sternocleidomastoid. That name seems kind of intimidating as well, but I think you're actually lucky when you get the name of this muscle because, again, it tells you what the origin and insertion is just when you look at the name of this muscle. For instance, sterno. What does sterno refer to? It's a bone. That's the sternum. Okay, so here's the sternum right here. And clido refers to the clavicle. Where's your clavicle at? That's your collarbone. So your sternum and collarbone are connected together. And the first part of a name of a muscle is what? The origin or the insertion? That's the origin, right? So the sternum and the clavicle are the origins of this muscle. And is that the more movable end or least movable end? That's the least movable end, and then we'll show you how that is. All right, and then the last part of this word is the mastoid. What did you learn about mastoid? I don't know if you learned. Yeah, I think you had an exam figure. You had to label that on an exam figure. The mastoid process of the temporal bone, which is this part right here, kind of underneath your earlobe. That's the mastoid process. So the sternocleidomastoid, and I think we have a really good picture of it right here. We see it's right here and right here. So here is one origin on the sternum. Here is a second origin on the clavicle. And the insertion is the mastoid process of the temporal bone. So if we look at it in a little zoomed in region, we see it right here because this is the mastoid process of the temporal bone. Okay, and sternocleidomastoid, that means that the mastoid process is the insertion of this muscle, which means what? It's the more movable end. So when the sternocleidomastoid contracts, right, so I'm pointing to my sternocleidomastoids right here. When these contract, if they both contract together, it's going to pull down on the mastoid process that's going to produce this motion that's called flexion of your neck. Okay, and then I have to extend my neck to look up and see you guys again. All right, so flexion is looking down. Extension is looking up like that. So that's one motion it produces, but I think you can see that you have two sternocleidomastoids, right? You've got one on the right side, one on the left side. And so that means you can contract one, but not the other. And if you contract one, it's going to not just flex your neck, but it's going to rotate it. So you can look from side to side if you relax one and contract the other. So that's pretty handy. So not only can you say, what's this? It's like my favorite answer. Okay? That's a yes motion. Right? Or if you only contract one, that's going to be your least favorite answer. Right? Or that's going to be a no motion. Okay. So that's sternocleidomastoid. So are you kind of getting a feel for how some of these muscles are named? It's pretty easy, right? Sternocleidomastoid. So the motion is, it can rotate the head if only one contracts, but if they both contract, it causes flexion. So that's pretty easy to see. All right, let's look at another muscle, a trunk muscle, the rectus abdominis. This is another good one to see. Rectus, sometimes muscles are named by the shape that they have, and rectus means straight. So this is just going to be a straight muscle without any kind of curves in it. And abdominis means that it's going to be over your abdominal cavity. So it's a straight muscle over your abdominal cavity. So where would you look? Abdominal cavity. And do you see any straight muscles? Right here. Right here, right here, right here. So this is the rectus abdominis. The origin is the pubic bone of the pelvic bone, which is right here, and the insertion is the xiphoid process of the sternum. Remember, the xiphoid process is that little tiny bone right at the inferior tip of the sternum. All right, so again, since the xiphoid process is the insertion, is that the more movable end or the least movable end? The more movable end. So when the rectus abdominis contracts, what bone is going to move? Is it going to be the pubic bone down here in the pelvis or the xiphoid process? Xiphoid process, and you can double check that. You can contract that muscle and see what moves. What's moving? My hips aren't moving. What? Well, they still move a little bit. My vertebral column is moving. Okay, so that's a good way to double check that origin and insertion. Okay, and so what does that produce? Flexion of the vertebral column. All right, so let's look at the upper limbs. Well, we looked at the brachialis already. The origin is the shaft of the humerus. I don't have a picture of it, but I'll show you this. I'll just draw it in. So the origin of the brachialis is going to be right about in this region here. That's the origin. And the insertion is the coronoid process of the ulna, which is right here. So here's a muscle right in this region. And when this muscle contracts, what motion is produced? It's going to flex your forearm, just like the biceps brachii. Okay, so this right here, so the humerus is not moving, so that's the origin. It's the ulna that's moving. So that's the insertion. So here would be what? The origin, and here would be the insertion. Okay. All right, so these muscles could possibly be on the test, these five muscles. All right, the last one, lower limbs, quadriceps femoris. Okay, quadriceps, sometimes, just like you noticed in the biceps, we name muscles by how many origins they have. So the biceps brachii has how many origins? It's got two. The quadriceps has how many? It's got four. Okay, so, and that's about as many as I've ever heard of, four different origins, okay, four different muscle groups. There's a rectus femoris. What does rectus mean again? That's the straight one. That's going to be a big, strong, straight muscle, just the most anterior muscle in your thigh. And so femoris means in your thigh, femoral region. Vastus lateralis. If you're going to look in somebody's thigh, where would you look? Medial or lateral? If you know it's the vastus lateralis. Yeah, it's going to be in the lateral part of your thigh. The vastus medialis is what? The medial or inner part of your thigh. And intermedius means in between medial and lateral. So those are the four muscle groups. And the origin for most of these are the femur. And the insertion is always the tibial tuberosity. Where's your tibia at? Where's your tibia? Can you remember where your tibia is? Yeah, it's your shin bone. That's in your leg. All right, so here are the muscles in the anterior thigh. So here is the anterior thigh right here. And they all insert into the tibia. This is the rectus femoris. Here is the vastus. Is this lateralis or medialis? This, oh, here is lateralis over here. Lateral is the outside. So here is, this is the medialis, and the intermedius we can't see because the rectus femoris is on top of it. All right, so you can tell a lot about muscles just by reading the name. You don't have to memorize everything. All right, so rectus femoris, it's a big straight one. Vastus lateralis, vastus medialis, and the intermedius we can't see because it's deep. It's underneath the rectus femoris. All right, so that's what you have to know about muscle. But I will tell you one other thing. We said that we like to name muscles by their shape sometimes. And here's a muscle at the top of a shoulder right here that's triangular shaped. All right, so this one is named triangle muscle, but not in that language. All right, it's called the deltoid. Okay, because deltoid means delta, which is what? Triangular shape. We've got a couple other muscles in the face in particular that are circular. Here's a nice circular muscle around the eyes. All right, what's the motion? What kind of motion does that produce? All right, that allows you to close your eyelids or winking. That would be the winking muscle right there. And so we call this the orbicularis oculi. Oculi means what? Around your eye. And orbicularis means a circular muscle. So anytime you see orbicularis, you're going to think of a circular skeletal muscle. Now, do you see an orbicularis anywhere else on this person? Okay, around the mouth. Look at here. In the lips of the mouth, here is an orbicularis, but it's not orbicularis oculi. This is orbicularis oris, standing for mouth. And so what does the orbicularis oris allow you to do? Okay, when it contracts, it's very important. For instance, for like whistling, stuff like that. Or if you're eating or chewing gum, especially if you're eating, what did your mom always tell you? Chew with your mouth closed. So you got to say, oh, mom, you mean I should contract my orbicularis oris? And she would say, yeah, of course, please. Because if you don't, what will happen? You have the orbicularis oris right there so that when you chew, food doesn't come out of your mouth. Right? So that food stays in your mouth. Okay, that's the importance of the orbicularis oris. So anytime you hear orbicularis, it's what? A circular muscle, skeletal muscle. Okay, so orbicularis, orbicularis, right, is a skeletal muscle. What does skeletal muscle mean? It's under voluntary control. All right, but it's circular. There's another kind of muscle that is circular, and we call that a sphincter. We'll see this later on in the class. All right, but a sphincter usually is made out of smooth muscle. What kind of muscle is smooth muscle? Is it voluntary or involuntary? It is involuntary muscle. So a sphincter is made out of smooth muscle, and it's usually in some kind of tube in your body, like maybe a blood vessel or part of your digestive tract. And when it contracts, it prevents flow of material from one part of the tube to another, so it acts like a valve or a gate sometimes. So a sphincter, maybe more generally and properly, would be smooth muscle, but orbicularis would be skeletal muscle. The difference is voluntary versus involuntary control. That's usually true. I could think of maybe one sphincter that is under voluntary control. There's one sphincter that is skeletal muscle. But generally, you could break them up into these categories like that. Okay. Okay. All right, well, let's look at the study guide. Because I'm done talking about muscle. Okay. All right, so what's the first question? Know the characteristics of skeletal muscle. Well, what does skeletal muscle do? It contracts. Right. It contracts. And it can also stretch. And if you stretch a muscle, it's elastic. It goes back to where it was originally. Okay, and another characteristic of muscle is that it is excitable. You can cause it to contract. So some of the characteristics that I'd like for skeletal muscle is contractility. It can contract. Let me get a good marker. It's contractile. That means it can contract. It is extensible. That means what? Stretch. And once it is stretched, and other muscles that are stretching it relax, the muscle goes back to its original length, so elastic is important. And, of course, it is excitable. That means it can go from a contracted state to a relaxed state, or a relaxed state to a contracted state. Okay. All right, so what are the functions of skeletal muscle? Movement. Okay. Movement, and it, when muscle contracts, it also maintains posture, right, for sitting up in a chair. When muscle contracts, it produces heat, so it helps maintain your body temperature, because none of us are at room temperature here. And the other important thing that it does is that it stabilizes joints, so it protects joints. Even when you're not moving, even when you're just sitting there. Okay, so let's see. What is the anatomy of a muscle? Know the fascia. All right, that is the connective tissue that's around a muscle. And so a muscle, like the biceps brachii, is an organ. So you want to break it down into its component parts. If we break a whole muscle organ down, the next smallest structure is what we call a fascicle. Or sometimes we call that a muscle bundle. You have a pretty good picture right here. All right, so here is the muscle organ, like the biceps brachii. And the connective tissue sheath surrounding this whole muscle is called the epimysium. The connective tissue that surrounds a fascicle is called the perimysium. And then there's a connective tissue sheath that surrounds every single muscle fiber, and we call that the endomysium. That should be on here someplace. Endomysium. Yeah, the endomysium. And a fascicle is a big bundle inside of a muscle. And every single cell, what do we call a muscle cell? It's called a fiber, because it's just a big, long, and narrow cell, extremely long, so we call that a fiber. And fibers are made up on the inside of these myofibrils. These are the organelles of contraction. And inside every organelle, we have the filaments. And what are the two kinds of filaments? Actin and myosin. That's right. And they slide past each other. You can see them interdigitated right here. What are these lines? Or what is the structure between these darker vertical lines right here? That's what we call a sarcomere. That's what shortens when the actin and myosin slide past each other. And then this yellow area right here, that's where calcium comes from. That's called the sarcoplasmic reticulum. The sarcoplasmic reticulum. So I think that's an exam figure, if I'm not mistaken. Okay, so myofibril makes up. Okay, let's start with the smallest stuff. What's the smallest stuff? Like actin and myosin, those are filaments. We put a bunch of filaments together, we get a myofibril. We put a bunch of myofibrils together, we get a fiber. And if we put a bunch of fibers together, we get a fascicle. And if we put a bunch of fascicles together, we get the whole muscle organ. So that's how you think of that. Okay. What two kinds of proteins make up myofilaments? Oh, that's so easy. Actin and myosin. Yes. Which one is the thick one? Myosin. The thin one is actin. What does the Z line represent? Z. It's the last letter of the alphabet. So it's the endpoints of a sarcomere, right? So the sarcomere goes from one Z line to another. And what is the structural and functional unit of a muscle called? A sarcomere, right? So if we look at this figure once again, in order to see how a muscle fiber shortens, the only thing we really have to understand is what? How that sarcomere shortens, how the Z lines come together, right? Because if we understand that, then we understand how the whole muscle fiber shortens. And then we understand how the whole muscle organ shortens as well. Okay. All right. What proteins contract or shorten when muscle contracts? You would say there are none that shorten. None of them. What really happens? Yeah, actin and myosin just slide over the top of each other. Okay. Name the description or model that describes how a muscle contracts. What do we call that? The sliding filament model, where the filaments just slide over each other, pulls the Z lines together, and that happens for every sarcomere in that muscle, so the whole muscle shortens. Okay. Why is muscle striated? Which means what? Why does it have that striped appearance? Because of the way the sarcomeres are lined up inside every muscle fiber. What is a cross bridge? What's a cross bridge? I think we can see here. So we're looking at a sarcomere. We see the Z lines. We see a sarcomere with myosin and actin. And we can see that there's sometimes, under certain conditions, when the muscle is excited, there's a connection between myosin and actin. And that connection is what we call a cross bridge. All right, so here's a cross bridge. So right in this picture of a muscle, they're not connected, so this muscle hasn't been excited into contracting, but this is a cross bridge. The cross bridges are found on one myofilament. What myofilament has cross bridges? The myosin filament, right? So it can reach up and grab hold of the actin under certain conditions, for instance, when there's calcium released from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, so what energy molecule is needed for muscle contraction? ATP, right, is the energy molecule ATP. What are the two ways that ATP is synthesized? It has to do with aerobic respiration and anaerobic respiration. Those are the two ways. And that's the whole point of respiration, is to make ATP. So be able to discuss the differences in aerobic and anaerobic respiration in terms of location. Where does anaerobic respiration take place? Cytoplasm. Where does aerobic respiration take place? Mitochondria. What about substrates? What does the cytoplasm need in order to make ATP? There's only one substrate. It needs glucose. And what about for mitochondria? Glucose as well as lipids, fatty acids. Okay, so glucose and fatty acids. Now what about products? What about the products for anaerobic respiration? Product for anaerobic respiration. Only 2-ATP, no CO2, and lactic acid. Right, so anaerobic respiration in a muscle produces discomfort or pain because it's producing lactic acid. All right, and what about the products for aerobic respiration? Let's see, what am I on, substrates or products? Did I get them confused? Products, okay, let's talk about products. The products for aerobic respiration are? Yeah, 36 ATP, a lot more ATP. Plus CO2 and water. And the last molecule that's produced is actually the water molecule. Right. Okay. What is the reason for respiration? Because you learn about all this CO2 and oxygen and glucose and lipids going here and there. But what's the whole purpose of respiration? Is to make ATP so that your cells can stay alive. All right, what causes fatigue? I think I said you didn't have to know this. But a decrease in ATP or an increase in lactic acid will make a muscle get weaker. no matter if you want it to contract or not. Okay, what are the definitions of origin? What's an origin of a muscle? It's the part of the muscle that doesn't move very much. And the insertion is the part that does move a lot. All right, so be able to name the origin and insertion of a muscle when given its name. So you know what, on the test, I might give you a name of a muscle you've never heard of. But that's okay because you haven't heard of very many muscles at all. You've only heard of maybe 5 or 6 muscles. Okay? But if you know nomenclature, you'll know what the origin is. Where do you find the origin in the name? That's the first part of the name. And the insertion is going to be the last part of the name of that muscle. So it's really easy to tell. Okay. What are synergist and antagonistic muscles? Synergist muscles do what? Perform the same kind of motion. Right? So if one is a flexor, the other is going to be a flexor. If one is an extensor, the other one's going to be an extensor. And what about for antagonistic muscles? These do what? Opposite motion. So if one's a flexor, what's the other one? An extensor. Right? Or if one is a abductor, the other is a adductor. Right? They work in opposition to each other. Now what about a prime mover? Prime mover is one muscle that does most of the work of what? Of synergist muscles. Muscles producing the same kind of motion. And be able to give an example of each. So, for instance, if I were to say biceps brachii and triceps brachii, would you say synergists or antagonists? Antagonists. And if I were to say biceps brachii and brachialis, would you say synergists or antagonists? Synergists, right? Because they're performing the same motion. And one of those two is the stronger one, biceps or the brachialis? It's actually the brachialis, okay? A lot of times we kind of think maybe it's the biceps brachii, but it's not. It's the brachialis. Okay. It just says, know the names and origins, insertions, actions of muscles described in lecture. Just those 5 muscles you have to know. And number 16, I don't know if I'm going to talk about that or not. Maybe just a little bit. I don't think I did in lecture. But this is an easy way to know muscles. All right. What are the actions of muscles in the anterior trunk or anterior arm? Well, let's look at my arm right here. What part is this? Anterior or posterior? Anterior. All the muscles in the anterior arm are going to cause flexion. Right? Even if you don't know all the names, if you maybe are someone tells you a name and you know where it is, you're going to know now the action is flexion. The posterior arm, all of these are going to produce extension because they're in opposite body compartments. They're going to be antagonistic to each other. All right, so anterior trunk. Where's the anterior trunk? Like the rectus abdominis. That's going to cause flexion of the vertebral column. The posterior trunk is going to cause the opposite motion, extension of the vertebral column. Okay, so the forearm. Okay, so here is the anterior forearm. When these muscles contract, okay, it's going to cause flexion of the fingers or flexion at the wrist. Wrist flexion or digit flexion. The posterior forearm is going to produce the opposite motion, which is what? Extension of the fingers or extension of the wrist. So it's pretty easy to see that. And the thigh. All of these muscles right here in your anterior thigh are going to, okay, extend the leg. The posterior thigh are going to flex. So flexion and extension of the leg happen in the anterior thigh and posterior thigh. And similarly, in the anterior leg and posterior leg, these in the anterior leg are going to lift your toes up off the ground, and you can feel that muscle contracting. What motion is that called? Lifting your toes up off the ground. That's a funny, funny name. That's called dorsiflexion. And so those happen in the anterior leg. The posterior leg, like there's a big muscle there called gastrocnemius. When it contracts, it forces your toes not up off the ground, but into the ground. What do we call pushing your toes into the ground? That's called plantar flexion. Okay, so when you guys really have to start studying a lot about muscles, that's the easiest way to do it, by body compartment. Just know actions of muscles by body compartment. And during the test, you could probably figure that out just by contracting a muscle in some body compartment. Okay, so that's it for muscle, unless somebody's got some questions about muscle. Okay, so we're going to move on to nervous system, but I'll maybe take some questions about muscle before I pass the quiz out. Now, how's it going finding your grades and finding the class notes? I hope it's okay. If you're having problems with that, see me after class, okay? See me after class, and I'll show you how to get onto Blackboard, because the handouts that I put on Blackboard are a really nice upgraded version. Why do I think of it as an upgraded version of the handouts that I've been just giving you in class? Because of the exam figures. You can practice labeling, right? So I'll do that from now on for every chapter that we're going to look at. I'll include the exam figures. So you can download those numerous times, or if you download it once and photocopy those figures, make 10 copies and label them 10 times, you'll get 100%, I'm sure, on that part of the test. All right, that will be easy to do. Unless there's absolutely no way that you're a visual learner. But we're all visual to some extent. All right, so nervous system. The nervous system is real important because it controls your body, it communicates with the environment, and it can transmit information very quickly in your body over long distances, because it does so using electrical signals. So your body is very electrical in nature. Nervous system can operate very fast. All right, so I'm going to give you an overview of the nervous system first. So you're going to have to fill in your notes. I don't have a bunch of arrows in your notes because I wanted you to fill them in as we're talking about it. All right, the nervous system has two main structural divisions, two main divisions to it. And the two main divisions are the central nervous system, and the second one is the peripheral nervous system. Well, where the heck are these? You'd have to go way back to the first chapter, I think, to see where the central nervous system is, because the central nervous system is made out of the brain and spinal cord. So brain is in the head, and the spinal cord is in the vertebral column. That's what makes the central nervous system. What about the peripheral nervous system? It's nerves everywhere else, right? It's everything outside the brain and spinal cord. So that's pretty much it. Okay, so central nervous system is brain and spinal cord. And peripheral nerves are everywhere outside the central nervous system. So give me an example of where you would find a peripheral nerve. Where would you find a peripheral nerve? Like in your hand or fingers, skin, arms, legs, trunk, someplace. Right? Those would all be peripheral nerves. Okay. And in the central nervous system, we have something called a tract, and we have something called a nucleus. Right, maybe jot that down and I'll tell you what that is maybe a little bit later today. Okay, and in the peripheral nervous system, we have receptors. A receptor is something that's necessary for your body to appreciate a certain kind of energy, a certain modality of energy. Light is an energy. Temperature is a form of energy. So you have to have, in order for you to see light, what do you need? You need eyes, which are receptors for light, right? All right, and in order for you to perceive temperature, you need receptors on your skin to sense temperature. Those are receptors. Tracts in the peripheral nervous system we just call nerves, and a nucleus that's in the central nervous system is something we call a ganglion in the peripheral nervous system. And I'm going to show you, that's almost the first thing that I'm going to show you when we actually start looking at some pictures. Okay, so furthermore, we're done pretty much talking about the central nervous system, but let's continue talking about the peripheral nervous system. The peripheral nervous system can be broken down into two divisions. There's a sensory division And there is a motor division. And I want you to get an understanding of what these two different things are. Sensory is picking up information in the periphery and taking it to your brain and spinal cord. So signals are only going in one direction, and that is from the surface on your body or from the outside world going into your brain and spinal cord. That is sensory. It's bringing information into your central nervous system. Motor, on the other hand, is taking information that starts in the central nervous system and it's being taken to your periphery, to some peripheral part of your body. So it's leaving your central nervous system. That's what a motor signal is. And we talk about those two systems. Sometimes we talk about it in terms of sensory and motor, but sometimes we say afferent and efferent. An afferent pathway is always going to be sensory. Which way is that going? Which way is an afferent signal? Is it entering or leaving your central nervous system? It's entering, right? And an efferent signal is going to be leaving your central nervous system, which is another way of saying motor. Okay? All right, so there's that sensory division. This motor division, guess what? We can break up into two parts. Let's break that up into two parts. There is one called somatic and another called autonomic. Somatic just means that it is voluntary. What part of your body do you have voluntary control over? Skeletal muscle, right? So in this case, since it's motor and it's somatic, it is pathways that go from your central nervous system, particularly to skeletal muscle, because those are what you have voluntary control of in your body. That's voluntary. All right, so what is involuntary in your body? Everything else besides skeletal muscle. That includes cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands. All right, so cardiac, smooth muscle, and glands are innervated by the autonomic nervous system. So you could actually think of automatic, but the proper term is autonomic. Your body, your central nervous system takes care of cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands all by itself. It doesn't need any help from your conscious thought. Okay. There are some nerves that are important, and you could probably take a note of this because I'll mention these nerves a little bit later on. A very important nerve in your somatic motor nervous system is called the phrenic nerve. And the phrenic nerve, anybody know where the phrenic nerve goes to? Real important nerve. The phrenic nerve goes to your diaphragm, which is a muscle that allows you to inhale. So if there's damage to the phrenic nerve, what happens? You can't breathe, right? And you need CPR until somebody can help you get breathing again. Okay? So the phrenic nerve is real important. There's another nerve, but this time it's for the autonomic nervous system. We call this the vagus nerve. And sometimes we give nerves numbers. This is a nerve number 10. We call that the vagus nerve, and the vagus nerve helps control the heart. So again, that's a real important nerve for you to know. So it doesn't hurt you to know something about the phrenic nerve and the vagus nerve. All right, now what else do you notice about the autonomic nervous system? How many arrows do you see? You see two arrows. So again, we can break the autonomic nervous system down into two parts. These are real important. These are the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system. Now, what can you tell me about antagonism? Is that a good thing to have in your body or a bad thing? It's really a good thing. And it just so happens that the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system are antagonistic to each other. So they're going to have opposite effects on your body, but that's really a good thing because then the nerves, your brain, right, has precise control and balance over various parts of your body because of that. So the autonomic nervous system, namely the sympathetic and parasympathetic, goes to where smooth muscle, to cardiac muscle, and to glands. And because it's based on antagonism, it gives you precise control and balance. So the autonomic nervous system is perfectly designed to control, what, unconscious functions in our body, because it's based on antagonism. So, for instance, you have sympathetic nerves that go to the heart, and you have parasympathetic nerves that go to the heart. The sympathetic will increase your heart rate. Sympathetic increases your heart rate. And now you can tell me what parasympathetic nerves do. They're going to do the opposite. They're going to slow your heart rate down. And because they work in opposition, your nervous system has precise control over your heart rate. And that's a really good thing, right? Because your heart is real important for keeping you alive. Okay. So in particular, the vagus right here, the vagus nerve, since it's part of the parasympathetic nervous system, it's responsible for slowing the heart rate down. Vagus slows the heart rate down, but the sympathetic nerve to the heart speeds it up. And when these two signals get mixed together right at the heart, your heart has exactly the right rhythm and heart rate as a result of that. Okay, so during this whole lecture, you might want to refer to this chart. So here is an overview of everything that we're going to look at in the nervous system, how it is organized. Sensory versus motor, central nervous system versus peripheral nervous system. So this is a pretty important slide. Your book has a pretty good picture too. Okay. All right, so let's look at some cells of the nervous system. Right, there are two kinds of cells that make up the nervous system. There's one kind of cell that carries electrical information, and then there's another one that doesn't carry electrical information. The one that carries electrical information is called a neuron. So a neuron can receive stimuli, and then it can transmit electrical signals, which we call action potentials. And anytime you see this word potential, you should think of another term that you might actually be a little bit more familiar with. Potential is exactly the same kind of word as voltage. Does anybody know what kind of voltage your car operates on? It's called 12 volts. Does anybody know how much voltage works around inside of a building? It's about 120 volts. Okay, and the voltage that your cells produce is really small. It's about 1,000 times smaller than your battery. It's about 70 millivolts. But nonetheless, all the cells in your body act like batteries. They produce voltage or potential. All right, so what kind of cell of the nervous system works by voltage or produces voltage or potential? It is the neuron right here. And it can send signals by changing its voltage. All right, so it's going to receive a stimulus. A part of a cell that's called a dendrite will pick it up, and it will send it out an axon. Okay, and notice that this signal always goes in one direction, from dendrite to cell body to an axon. So what do these things look like? Here's a picture of a neuron, and this is a pretty typical picture of a neuron that's in the peripheral nervous system. And these are weird shapes. It's not like any kind of cell really that we've looked at before. They're not cuboidal. They're not flat. They've got what? All of these things sticking out of them. And we call these processes, just like on a bone. If something's sticking out of a bone, we call that a process. All right? Well, here is the center of mass of the cell. And this mass right here has got the nucleus, and it's got a bunch of organelles. So this is the part of a neuron that we call the cell body, because it's got most of the pieces of the neuron, including the nucleus and all this other substance. Sometimes we call this chromatophilic substance because it can absorb light. It can give the cell body color to it. Another name for cell body sometimes is called soma. Guess what soma means? It means, okay, it means body. Soma means body. What language is that? Anybody know what language that is? Yeah, it's either Latin or Greek. I don't know which one it is. I was hoping somebody could tell me. But it's probably Greek. I'm not sure. Soma means body. That's the cell body. All right, and then we see a really long process over here, and then a bunch of very small processes coming off the cell body. The small ones here are what we call dendrites. And this really long one is what we call an axon. So that's the three main parts of a neuron. The cell body, these short processes that are dendrites, and this one long one is what we call an axon. And The dendrites and cell body are the receiving end of the neuron, and the axon is the sending part. Okay, so dendrites receive information, send it to the cell body, and then it moves down an axon. And that information is what we call an impulse, a nerve impulse. And so you can see this arrow right here is pointing down an axon to an axon terminus or terminal. It's not pointing up to a cell body. So electrical signals always go from where? From dendrites to a cell body to an axon. It never goes backwards. I don't think we're really going to learn in this class why that is, but you should just be aware of that. And if you ever end up taking a physiology class, you'll see what about this neuron that only allows it to go in one direction. Okay? So I'm just inviting you to take a physiology class sometime. Okay. But first, this class. All right, so this is what we call, since it's sending electrical signals, would you call this a neuron? Or the second kind of cell, which we haven't talked about yet, which is a neuroglia. Okay? Neuroglia is the second kind of cell that makes up the nervous system. All right, but because this is sending electrical impulses or nerve impulses, this one here is a neuron, not a neuroglia or neuroglial cell. Okay, so the second kind of cell is a neuroglia cell. Doesn't send electrical impulses. Right? And so for many, many years, people were not very interested in neuroglia since it didn't send electrical impulses anyplace. But guess what? We've learned some real important functions of neuroglia, and probably most people are more interested now in neuroglia than neurons because we're trying to catch up with our understanding on how the nervous system works. All right, neuroglia synthesizes a compound, a chemical called myelin, and myelin is a lipid. And it wraps itself around an axon. And just like when you have a wire at home, okay, like if you plug in a power cord to a TV set or something, can you just grab the power cord and plug it into the wall, or you have to worry about getting electrocuted? You just plug it in. Why can you just grab wires coming out of your TV set and just plug it in? Because it has rubber or plastic around the wires that insulates the wires from you. So the electricity can't come out of the wires and electrocute you. The same thing for certain parts of the nervous system. There is insulation surrounding an axon. That insulation is myelin. And that just keeps the electricity inside the axon. We're going to see in particular some other functions that it does. But myelin acts as insulation around an axon. Neuroglia are support cells. They maintain the health of nerve cells, and they insulate neurons. Some of them secrete myelin, right? So sometimes these neuroglia tell neurons how to connect up to each other, and it maintains the health of neurons, and it keeps the connections just right, because the reason why humans are smart is not because we have a lot of neurons, it's because we have a lot of interconnections between neurons that makes us smarter than most kinds of animals. Okay, and it's the neuroglia that tell these neurons how to connect up with each other, which is real important. And neuroglia also make the blood-brain barrier. And I'll show you what the blood-brain barrier is a little bit later on. All right, so remember this slide right here that shows you a neuron. You see the dendrites, the cell body, and these axons. But look at this axon right here. Can you see these little rolls right here? These are what we call neuroglia cells. And in particular, these are Schwann cells. And the Schwann cells are synthesizing myelin, which is an insulation that wraps itself around these axons. So a Schwann cell is a kind of neuroglia. And it's a kind of neuroglia cell that we see in the peripheral nervous system. That's why I have PNS right here, in the peripheral nervous system. And before I stop to pass the quiz out, I'm going to tell you just a little bit about what myelin does. Okay? If this cell did not have these Schwann cells, an electrical impulse would have to be transmitted from one molecule to the next molecule to the next to the next to the next to the next to the next. All right? But when there are Schwann cells, the nerve impulse actually hops from one end of a Schwann cell to the next, to the next. So a nerve impulse will hop down an axon. And what do you think is faster? If it has to go molecule by molecule by molecule, or if it can skip down an axon, which is faster? Skipping, right? So if a nerve impulse can go from one node between the cells, we call these a node of Ranvier, it's a very fast way of conducting a signal. So what's better, faster or slower? If you buy a computer, do you want a slow computer or a fast computer? You want a fast one, right? So a myelinated neuron is faster, and that's better. And you have to have these Schwann cells on these axons in order to do that. All right, so we're going to start next time looking at these neuroglia cells. So these are not the neurons, they're neuroglia. So I'm going to start here next time. Now, anybody have any questions over the muscles before we take the quiz? Questions on muscles? No? Okay. All right, so get out an 882. And I'll turn the projector off and my recorder. And today, can't use your notes. Okay, but you'll get a quiz later on where you can use your notes.